the reason why lower air pressure breaks down at a much smaller voltage. So that gives you a little bit of an understanding of what an arc is like, what a the beginning of an arc is like. Now, when it comes to sparks and arcs, you'd be amazed how much science went into that around the 1910 time frame. Let me drop.
1830.
Somewhere around 1810, 1820, and on Long Island at the Siemens Company, had a 250,000-watt spark gap transmitter. And how did they do that? Lots of high voltage was across that spark. The spark was in an internal chamber which had just the right kind of gas in there, I forget what the gas was, with a strong local magnetic field. I am guessing the reason for the magnetic field is because as the arc occurred, they wanted the arc to continuously move. They didn't want to burn a hole in one little place of those metal electrodes that are in that spark. But that spark was the transmitting signal connected with an impedance matching device to the antenna that did the transmitting. 250,000 watts of arc. Man, that is a lot of steam. The actual velocity of those electrons in the arc, I think, are slightly below the speed of light. You get a little hint about that when you read the articles on how does lightning propagate.
I have a comment on this.
After the lightning bolt has done its original streamers of ionizing the air, and you get the return stroke, the return stroke moves at something like, as I remember, one-third or one-half the speed of light. Go ahead, Wesley. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Two factors. One of them, in 1924, there was Erwin Otto Marx, M-A-R-X, and he created Marx Generator, which actually consists for the series of connected pi networks, which would be actually the coil, but it was treated as a resistor, connected to another one in series in one leg, in the upper leg, and the lower leg you had the same, but then you had in between them, in parallel, the capacitors connected. Now, across each square, so we have a resistors on the top leg, resistors on the lower leg, we have a capacitors between them, from the between these legs, and then across we have a spark gap. So actually the upper corner between the first resistor and the connection of the capacitor on the top has across the wire that goes to the spark gap to the lower right corner. So upper left corner to the lower right corner. And that was actually the purpose to generate a high voltage pulse. Now, Sandia National Laboratories used that to generate X-ray into the G machines. Let me jump. Now, there was a scientist in 1833, and that scientist was Sir Charles Wheatstone, W-H-E-A-T-S-T-O-N-E. He was born in 1802 and died in 1875. Now, he was actually working with telegraphs, but then he got into the velocity of the electricity. And there is a number of articles wrote by him, very interesting, how he was able to acquire the speed of the electricity by using coils with the miles of wires on it. And also using the piano strings, script strings, and trying to compare the speed of sound to the speed of light, and finally get to the speed of electricity. But he was also using the special mirror. It's all mathematical equation in it, and that was done in 1833. But my question to you is,
thank you.
kind of confused with the fact that you say that free electrons, okay. Based on the discussion that I have had with Glenn, we get to the conclusion that electrons never leave the atomic structure. And the colliders are built for the purpose of real free electrons or free particles that could be actually speeded up. But then you say, well, we have a free electrons, which I remember when I was young, I was taught this way. Now, at first we do not know why the electrons speed from the beginning of it. What gives them the power to speed? And the second thing is, if they leave the structure of atom, they actually destroy the atom. Now, it's a lot of confusion in this area. Back to you, and to Ajir.
When you Google the word high voltage experiment, you'll find a whole lot of hits and a whole lot of interesting articles and photographs and whatever. And the MOX generator is one of the very popular circuits that people experiment with. When you study what a MOX generator is, it looks a little bit like a voltage multiplier rectifier network, but it's not a rectifier, but it looks like one. And what's really happening is that when you're charging those individual capacitors, you are charging them all in parallel. But once you get one of those spark gaps of the MOX generator, which got a whole lot of spark gaps, when one of them breaks down, all of a sudden, those two local capacitors have been put in series. So when the whole MOX generator goes through its arcing process, all of the capacitors that you charged in parallel are suddenly put in series. So if you had a 10-stage MOX generator, you could get close to a 10-to-1 voltage multiplication out of it. The later version of it that was used for particle accelerators was the so-called Cockcroft-Walton voltage multiplier assembly. But MOX is one of the very famous ones. Now, when it comes to electrons, I say electrons really do move. Let me show you why. Let me drop. The IEEE and the National Bureau of Standards defines 1 ampere of current flow as 1 coulomb's worth of electrons passing one point in the circuit in 1 second. That's the definition of 1 ampere. A coulomb's worth of electrons, roughly 10 to the 19 electrons, must flow through the point of observation in 1 second, and when that happens, you call it a current flow of 1 ampere. Those electrons really are moving. But there's a catch. Remember that experiment now with the starter motor and the red electron coming out of the negative lead of the battery. What is the average velocity of those electrons as far as their linear motion is concerned? It's extremely slow. 4 hours to flow through 3 feet of wire with 200 amperes of current flow. 4 hours for 3 feet of wire. That's a very slow average velocity. They're jumping all over the place locally, but the average velocity is very slow. However, the sensing of the current flow is very fast. At the instant you close that solenoid switch, let me drop. At the instant you close that solenoid switch at the starter motor, 3 nanoseconds later, 3 feet away of wire, the battery knows about it. 3 nanoseconds later, 200 amperes are flowing. So you jostle one of those marbles in the pipe, so to speak, at the far end. The difference in pressure is propagated through that pipe a nanosecond per foot. The difference in pressure is propagated very fast. But the individual electrons, and there's a huge number of them, on average, their velocity is very slow. It's a weird mixture of fast and slow. That's what happens in copper wire. In the case of an arc, something somewhat similar is taking place. That arc consists of a large number of electrons that are flowing, and microscopically, and they have to be moving fast enough to give you this avalanche effect of impact ionization. Each individual one is accelerated through 63 nanometers of distance and reaches a velocity high enough that when it impacts the next air molecule, it ionizes the air molecule. It breaks away at least one more electron to start the avalanche effect. So microscopically, tremendous velocities are taking place. But the average current flow velocity through the arc is similar to the current flow through that copper pipe. You could say it's very slow. So from one point of view, you could say the electrons stay very local to their local nucleus of that molecule, and not much action is taking place. But real electrons have to be flowing in order to fit the definition of 1 ampere of current flow through one point of observation. Maybe this helps a little bit. N2XJM, K2RIW.
Yes, it does. Although the confusion is still present. I would love Glenn to actually take a stand on it. Now, we have H2O, which is the water, and HHO, which is actually Kazuo's representation of what water was once. So HHO would be the 2 atoms of hydrogen and 1 atom of oxygen. Okay, fine. Now, if you look at the Mendeleev table of substance, I don't know if I translated it properly, where you have any possible metal or lack of wording, and you have them all in one table, the variation between them is because of the contents of the atoms of a metal, let's say, and also each atom of metal consists from the number of a characteristic structure in this atom. Then it says, what is what over there? If that what is not existing because actually you took it apart, then you actually distorted the atom structure. So my question at first is, why the electron is spinning? And what is so significant pattern or signature of the atom that is already distorted? Back to you.
I may not be able to help you on this one, Wesley. The cloud of electrons around every nucleus of every atom. In the case of a simple atom like a hydrogen molecule, that lower two electrons or one electron is somewhat easy to understand. It's probably a nearly circular orbit, sort of like a planet going around the sun. But as you start building up the greater number of electrons in a particular atom, a more complicated atom, they move in very peculiar ways that I don't quite understand. And why the two hydrogen atoms group to the oxygen atom in a water molecule, why they don't arrange themselves on opposite sides of the hydrogen atom, why the two hydrogen atoms, the oxygen atom, why do the two hydrogen atoms group themselves together on one side with something like 109 degrees of difference in their spacing compared to the center of the oxygen atom? Why they do that is not clear to me.
Yeah, but why the electric current is able to split them, the water, to the gaseous substances? You just take the bucket of water, you put two electrodes in it, and that would be the stainless steel electrodes. You put 12 volts from your battery, and immediately you're going to see bubbles. That's your HHO. So we're talking about now current reversing the structure, molecular structure of the substance. That's why the conflict, what I see in here, is that electricity could distort the structure of individual atom, making this
repeater timeout. Repeater timeout. Cancel.
You're now asking, why does electrolysis take place? And electrolysis takes place, in my opinion, that's where you put two two electrodes and a water-like substance pass current through it, and you get oxygen forming at one electrode and hydrogen forming at the other electrode. And you're breaking down the water into its individual constituents, hydrogen and oxygen, and that process is called electrolysis. And you can reverse the process by putting those two gases together and igniting them, and you get a small explosion, and you get water back again. Now, the water itself is a dipole molecule. The fact that those two hydrogen atoms are on one side and the oxygen atom, you could say, is on the other side, makes it a dipole molecule. It's got local polarity, and that makes water behave the way it does in a microwave oven. You get microwave heating. However, pure water with no contaminants in it is almost a perfect insulator. If I had water that's pure enough, and I put it inside of your electrolysis machine, and you apply the 12 volts to those two electrodes, nothing will happen. You must put a ionizing solution into that water, salt or some other ionizing material. When you dissolve salt into water, the sodium chloride breaks up into sodium atoms and chlorine atoms that are moving somewhat freely around those water molecules. The combination of that ionizing substance in the water gives you the conductivity that allows you to do the electrolysis. Pure water will not electrolyze. It is almost a perfect insulator. I know that's only part of the story. I don't quite understand yet how electrolysis helps, takes place, but maybe that helps a little bit. N2XJN, KQLIW.
N2XJN. Thank you very much for all of this information. I was driving you to the point in which I was trying to show that electricity in the way that we understand it, that means electrons leave the structure of the atoms, will disturb the atomic structure. The atomic structure is the primary and the basic structure for the elements that we have on Earth, all of the metals, all of the substances. And when you look at the Mendeleev table, you see how many, what this atom is consists from. How many protons, how many electrons, everything that is inside. Now, electricity is able to react with water that is not necessarily pure one, but at the same time, copper appears to be kind of immune to it. But at the same time, ionization, electricity that is creating ionization, electricity that is actually flowing through the copper, is distorting the structure of atomic structure. So we should have something different than copper right now, and we can see the same situation in water. Now, what is the difference between the particles, free particles in the collider in Europe, and the particles that we have in the electric conductor, like a copper? What is the free particle that is being speeded up in the collider? Back to you.
You just hinted that copper changes its characteristic when current flows through it. I think that's not true.
Of course it's not true. I'm just trying to find an analogy to this.
All of those copper atoms in that copper bar that's in the wire that's in front of me right now are locked together in a matrix. And those individual atoms of copper do not move. They're locked together in a matrix. However, each one of those copper atoms has an outer ring of electrons. There's multiple rings of electrons, but the outer ring has some free electrons that are capable of moving. And one of the articles I've written that seems to be reasonably well written states that whenever you and I look at a metal, we know most of the time the difference between metal and insulator. Our eyes tell us that that has a metallic look to the surface. What is that metallic look? This guy is telling me that the free electrons floating around the outside of those copper molecules, those copper atoms, are what you're looking at when you think you see that shiny metallic surface. You're looking at the actual electrons on the surface, the ones that are free to move. That's his hypothesis. He might be right. When you and I put salt into that water, because we're doing electrolysis, the salt breaks up into a ionized substance, chlorine atoms and sodium atoms and chlorine atoms, and the chlorine atoms have one polarity, the sodium atoms have another polarity, and when you apply a voltage, those ionized atoms of sodium and chlorine begin to move. And maybe they move at a fast enough velocity to create impact ionization of a water molecule, and it breaks the water molecule down from its oxygen and hydrogen components. That's a guess on my part, that it's impact ionization of the sodium ions and chlorine ions that is doing the electrolysis. Because water all by its...
Repeater, time out, cancel.
Because pure water by itself will not conduct electricity, will not electrolyze. Now, there's a chemical engineer that I work with every day, and I'm going to ask him some more questions about what is really happening at the molecular level during electrolysis when there's a salt solution in there. And that salt solution doesn't have to be sodium chloride. It can be a whole lot of other ionizable materials. But you have to make the water conductive first before you can do electrolysis. And I'm going to ask this chemical engineer a little bit more about that tomorrow. And I hope to find out a little bit more about what's going on, because it's not clear.
Yeah, but could you also ask him one more question?
You want to know how I do electrolysis?
In 1998, he's got a patent for a generator generating HHO from the water. And he was able to power up his buggy car with that. But it's not what I'm talking about. He used the resonant circuit. And it is not a secret that when you plug the battery to the bucket of water, you're getting a current drawing about 40 amps. When you build a simple resonant circuit with the proper frequency, you are drawing about 2 amps, and you're having the same manufacturing of the HHO as you had with 40 amps. Of course, the solution that is added to it helps, but even though that people were using a completely pure distillated water, they still had a science of the processes that were converting water into the HHO. Back to you.
I'm going to turn it over to Eric in a minute because he wants to make a comment on this, but I'm a little bit skeptical of this one, Wesley. In order to get a given volume of oxygen and a given volume of hydrogen out of water that is being electrolyzed, I'm using the electrolysis process to break water down into hydrogen and oxygen, it is my belief that a given amount of current is required to break that number of bonds to give me the separate hydrogen and oxygen. And by way of fancy substances and resonance and whatever, requiring a smaller amount of current to give me the same amount of hydrogen and oxygen, I'm having a problem with that. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I'm starting off skeptical. But maybe Eric can clear this up for us, because he's done some electrolysis. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I have a comment also, Dick.
Okay, John, but Eric first.
All right, K2RIW, K2EJ. As you know, we have a couple of vehicles that have electrolyzers in the vehicle using what people like to call brown gas, HHO, or a mixture of hydrogen and oxygen gas together into the vehicle. And if you go on the web and type in water car, you'll see there's lots of guys doing it. One way is, of course, you need a catalyst. You need something to make the water conductive. So some people use potassium hydroxide. Some people use baking soda. But there's actually a series of formulas that will show you to create 1 liter of gas per minute requires, it requires like 1.36 kilowatts of energy in order to do that. It doesn't matter what the catalyst is. Well, let me drop for a second. You'll find guys out there that do things that they think actually work, like the pulse width modulate the energy going into the electrolyzers. The electrolyzers are set up in different ways. Some of them have teeth points. Some of them are screens. A lot of people are using 316L stainless, which, by the way, the stainless itself leaches some material. But you can also take 63 megahertz and actually tilt the axis of the hydrogen atoms. When you apply the juice to the electricity for the electrolysis, quote unquote, it's more efficient. Although I haven't been able to do it, but there are other people that claim that they can. So there you go. K2RW, K2J.
Yeah, I'm also a little skeptical about 63 megahertz. There's nothing magic about that number. The very first water molecule resonance is around 21 gigahertz. Individual oxygen molecules.
Dick, if you look at any MRI, it just changes the axis of the hydrogen. That's the frequency, and I don't remember. It's like 2 or 3 teslas that they generate at that frequency.
Completely free hydrogen atoms have their first resonance at 1420 megahertz, and I'm having trouble believing that they go any lower than that. Completely free oxygen molecules have their first resonance at around 63 gigahertz. So way down at a low frequency of 63 megahertz, I'm having trouble believing it. 1420 megs for free hydrogen atoms is the first resonance. So are they really getting a resonance phenomenon? I think not. You know of people doing the experiment at 63 megahertz, and I think you're saying as an independent experimenter, you didn't see the benefit. Is that roughly true, Eric? Go ahead.
Eric said enabling access. That's what he said.
What I said is it tilts the axis of the hydrogen atoms that attached to oxygen. But let me pull up the Wikipedia page, and you can look at the thing about the hydrogen at 63 megahertz.
But once again, do you believe a confirmable 63 megahertz benefit has truly been demonstrated, from your knowledge on it? Eric, go ahead.
You know, there's a lot of baloney on the internet, and there are people who claim it, but I ain't never seen it.
Okay, so you are skeptical that 63 megahertz can give a significant benefit. John, KC2WGB, you're going to clear this all up for us? I'm having some fun with you. You go ahead, John, K2RIW.
The same thing with pulse width modulation.
Yeah, I agree with you there. It's the average power that does anything when it comes to heating a human being or breaking down water in electrolysis. I think it's average power. John, you got it.
KC2WGB. Dick, I just wanted to point out, I did some experiments with a high pot machine and triple distilled water. And distilled water is not a conductor, and that was at 50,000 volts. So just to give you an idea, it was no difference between the separation in air or in the H2O.
I'll argue with that. If you had said deionized water, yes, but distilled water, no.
Well, hold on now. You put 50 kilovolts, I think you said, over what distance? What do you believe was the volts per meter in your somewhat purified water in which you did not get the breakdown or conductivity? How many volts, how many inches, therefore, or centimeters, what do you believe was the volts per centimeter, John? Go ahead.
Spacing of the electrodes were approximately 6 inches, and it was 200 milliliters of water, triple distilled.
And how many volts did you put across that 6 inches?
50,000.
So that would be 30,000 per inch. Then we have for 6 inches, we have much less.
Yeah, he's under 10,000 volts or 12,000 volts per inch. I think you're saying that the conductivity in that experiment was very low, like, was it microamps or picoamps, from your recollection, John? Go ahead.
20 microamps, 22 microamperes, that's what I believe. Yes, it was 20-something, I think it was 22.
Did that steam distill water?
Steam and electrostatic process.
You're talking about deionized water, way different, lots more expensive. Steam distilled water is still kind of conductive, sorry.
KC2QAQ.
Yeah, and you got to be very careful as to what kind of containers you put the water in to make sure you haven't recontaminated it. Okay, so we're on to electrolysis here tonight, Glenn, and maybe you can shed some light on all this. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I wish everybody a Happy New Year first, but just the one quick thing I want to throw out there is water does have a real resistance to it. I mean, it's not a pure isolator. Granted, it's high, don't get me wrong, but pure, purified water, its resistivity is somewhere like 2.5 times 10 to the 5th ohms per meter. So it's not a really, and that's a, keep in mind also, that changes with temperature and pressure, so that's a 20C and 1 ATM. So, yeah, it's a pretty high number. 2.5 times 10 to the 5th is pretty high, but I guess if you have pretty high voltages, you can get some current flow. KC2QIQ. Back to you, Dick.
As I slowly raise the voltage across very pure water, I am guessing at first it essentially obeys Ohm's law. In other words, I know the resistivity, I know the amount of area and the spacing of my plates, and I can measure a current flow in microamperes. I'd love to know at what number of volts per meter does it suddenly start using some other phenomena, somewhat like the ionization and breakdown of air, the dielectric. Does water have a defined, does really pure water have a defined dielectric strength in volts per meter? What do you think, Glenn?
That's difficult to say because I think it also depends on the volume. You have a volume equation problem here. So, you know, depending on the, you know, it's like the same thing with copper and length. That, yeah, I mean, you can put carbon into a resistor, but depending on its width and length, that's going to give you a voltage breakdown. So here again, there, you know, there's a lot of variables here. When you're talking about a large volume of water, if you had a big, big, big old tank of many, many meters square, and you were to, you know, basically put a take a resistance measurement across 1 meter of water, 20C at 1 ATM, it's going to be about 2.5 times 10 to the 5th. And there again, I would think that the dielectric strength for voltage is still going to be pretty high. But when you get into smaller and smaller volumes of water, that may no longer be the case because of ionization issues and lower energy types of... how can I say? In other words, one of the things with electrolysis is things want to move to lower energy states because you're applying energy and you're adding to the chemical bond. You're adding an extra electron which can separate ions, so you'll actually break a chemical bond at that point. But let me pass back to you, Dick. I hope I'm not going to be confusing people now. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I can see how the volumetric problem adds difficulty, but there's ways I can simplify it. I can take a high-quality glass tube, which is, let me pick a number, half a centimeter in diameter, thin-walled tubing, and I could make it, let me pick a number, 3 centimeters long, and I could have it filled with pure air and with two electrodes on the two ends, and I could put high voltage across those, and I'm reasonably sure I'm going to reconfirm that air has a dielectric strength in this glass tube, this column of air, is good for 30,000 volts per centimeter. If I now substitute pure water in that same glass tube, what's your guess as to what the dielectric strength might look like, Glenn? Go ahead.
Well, here again, without contaminants, I think it would be pretty darn close. Almost the same, Dick.
Okay, so you're saying your first guess is that the dielectric strength of really pure water in that confined environment that I just described might be similar to the dielectric strength of air. And now, in the case of the universal gas laws, you know pretty much what is the separation in nanometers between all of those air molecules. The Avogadro's number for an ideal gas makes most of the gases a rather well-defined substance. And are we using an almost similar number of molecules of water in the water substance? And is it again an impact velocity that creates the cascading of ionization of water during a high voltage breakdown process? Let's see what Eric's got to say on this one. We got to do some experiments or do some more research as to what is the real dielectric strength of a confined column of pure water. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, I was just looking at nuclear magnetic resonance, though. I think what you're asking, oh, by the way, the frequency is 48, where is it again? It's 42.58 to cause this spin axis to tilt. And there's different frequencies which do different stuff depending upon what atom we're talking about. So, you know, when they're not necessarily talking resonance in the sense that you think of resonance, so. You know, I have somewhere the actual dielectric strength of truly pure water, which is distilled and deionized, and it's somewhere in the hundreds of megohms. Somewhere I actually have the actual values. It's been a couple of years since I worked on it, but and the other thing that, going with what Glenn was saying, in the process of doing electrolysis, you actually wind up with ions, and even though you separate the two gases, they have the propensity to recombine because of the lack of an electron.
So I think you're saying that when the hydrogen atoms first come out of the electrolysis fluid and the oxygen atoms come out of the electrolysis fluid, at first they are already ionized. In other words, they are not neutral substances. I would guess by the time they bubble up through the solution from the electrodes that are buried in the solution, that they find a free electron somewhere, and by the time they come out as a gas, I'm having trouble believing that the O2 molecules and the H2 molecules, I'm of the belief that they're going to be deionized when they come out of solution, Eric. I'm going to pass it back to you for a comment on that one. Also, when you talked about the many megohms of water, you're talking about resistivity, not dielectric strength. Dielectric strength I would rate in units of volts per meter or volts per centimeter. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
All right, well, here's the theory. Here's the theory you're going to have trouble with, is that you know that hydrogen, to exist as a gas, as we say, has to have two atoms, okay? We don't think of a singular atom of hydrogen, or even a singular atom of oxygen, okay? But a lot of what is split, if you actually calculate the energy, there's a whole lot of stuff been written on this. You're actually dealing with a single atom of hydrogen and a single atom of oxygen. By the time it bubbles out of the water, it becomes water again. Okay, that's what I'm talking about. Not the stuff that actually makes it out. Those are perfectly imbalanced.
Okay, if the free H2s and O2s in the solution, some of them turn back into water, that means you're losing some of the process that you're trying to make. And how do the energy equations of amperes and liters of gases, how does that balance if some of it's being reconverted? Lots of people have done electrolysis, and it appears to me, from what I've read, they get a given volume in liters per ampere, and that it comes out right. Are you telling me that if you could stop it from recombining by, like, maybe putting the electrodes very close to the surface, not giving it an opportunity to recombine, would the process be made more efficient? Over to you, Eric, K2LIW.
Yeah, that's what people have been striving for, to make it more efficient. Because it takes a lot of energy to split water. It ain't easy, otherwise everybody would be doing it. The auto manufacturers are not stupid. Although, I think it was about 6 months ago, something was going on at Exxon where they're actually making it more efficient. Although they don't give you much information, it may all be just an advertising deal. But I'm actually trying to find my folder, which has all this stuff in it, and I can't find it at the moment. So, it actually is what people are striving for, to make it more efficient, to get, you know, put every ounce of energy that you put into it to actually get real gases out of it. In the traditional sense, when you do electrolysis, right, mathematically, you get, when you separate the hydrogen and the oxygen from two, let me let it drop, and you're collecting the gases either as like a Venturi device where you have two electrodes that are actually isolated in a common water solution, so that way you're capturing hydrogen from one pipette tube and you're capturing oxygen in the other pipette tube. That works out to the T. What we're talking about here is when we actually have both electrodes in close proximity to each other without any separation of collection. So the idea is to make what they call Brown's gas, which is gaseous H2 with gaseous O2 at the same instant. There are other methods to create, like even a fuel cell on backwards with a PEM membrane in between it, where you have the isolation of hydrogen and oxygen. There, the math works out perfectly. Where we're talking about is where we're trying to take both gases at the same time without any kind of mechanical separation of those molecules.
Hydrogen and oxygen, when I combine them in a rocket engine, gives me a lot of energy. When the space shuttle takes off, he's 4.5 million pounds of mass with 6.5 million pounds of thrust. Yes, a lot of it is the solid rocket boosters, but those liquid-fueled engines running on liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, which are made into the gaseous form before they're putting into the chamber, tremendous amounts of energy.
Yeah, but you're missing the point. They use frozen depository of each one, and they mix them together. That's why they have this energy. Now, in here, you have already the composition that is being delivered.
Good guess, but I don't agree. They start off with liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen because that's the most compact way that they can be cryogenically put into those tanks, and you get the most amount of energy per liter of tank, or per cubic meter of tank. However, the pumping mechanism that works on that hydrogen and oxygen makes it into a pure gaseous form before it is put into that combustion chamber.
Now, it's a combination of that and the reaction walls of the engine itself.
But I think it is pure gaseous hydrogen and gaseous oxygen that are being mixed in that combustion chamber. The majority of that action is gases. The bottom line of all this is I could also take 2 moles of hydrogen and 2 moles of oxygen, the right number of liters of each, put them into some kind of a container, and pass a spark through that container, I'm going to get an extremely violent reaction. It's a bomb. If I don't do it carefully, I'm going to explode the container that I put it in, and I'm going to create damage in the room where I do that. What I'm getting at is combining oxygen and hydrogen to make a water molecule, tremendous amounts of exothermic energy are given off. I believe the process obeys reciprocity. Therefore, when I'm doing electrolysis, I must put in that amount of energy to re-separate them. Am I wrong on that one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
No, that's absolutely correct, Dick. And you also have to figure the conversion losses. What NASA does is, you know, they don't do it by electrolysis. They do it by liquefying air. So that's how they get their cryogenic volume. By the way, it's 2 moles of hydrogen, 1 mole of oxygen. Otherwise, you'd be making hydrogen peroxide. Hydrogen dioxide, that is.
And also, in order to avoid the problem, when you manufacture the HHO, use the bubbler, which is actually... Eric would be able to better to explain that.
Yeah, let me ask you this question, Eric. If there was some easy way of taking pure water, separated into hydrogen and oxygen, and plugging it into my engine, I'd have a nice, clean, running automobile, no carbon emissions, water comes out of the exhaust pipe, and I could pour the water back in, by the way, into the process. If there was a simple way of separating hydrogen and oxygen from water, we'd be running our cars on it. I think it takes a tremendous amount of energy to do it. I think there's no way to cheat the system, and therefore, the chances of us really running an automobile on water, you and I doing that in the near future, I don't think is very likely, but maybe you know more about this. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
All right, well, the water car, there's a lot of hearsay about it. There's supposedly a company in Japan that's doing just that. But if you figure out the math and you figure out the volumes of gas that you need to run a typical, you know, 200 cubic inch engine, it's huge. It's monstrous. The amount of energy, first of all, hydrogen is really not a fuel. It's a carrier of energy, all right? Although everything that burns, any kind of combustion has to have hydrogen, whether you're burning paper or gasoline or anything else. The more units of hydrogen you have, the more energy that you can spit out of a unit volume. So, you know, if you're comparing a gallon of gasoline and comparing that to hydrogen, there's a huge amount of volume that you need. That's why I like the space shuttle. Rather than using hydrazine, some other stuff, which would have less volume that they would have to carry. That's why they have that huge external tank. You know, you've got to consider gram for gram. What's more dense? The hydrogen's the lightest thing we know in the universe. It's not the most dense, so, you know. But the idea of burning HHO is that you assist in combustion in a typical internal combustion engine. Let me let it drop. And in the experiments that my friend and I have done, we've actually reduced the amount of hydrocarbons, created more complete combustion, have added between 20% and 30% improvement in efficiency of burning of the gasoline, but it's not just sticking in the engine. You also have to tell the engine that you're going to change the dwell angle because don't forget, gasoline burns very slowly. It's a slow-burning thing. We're putting hydrogen and oxygen in there. We're speeding up the combustion, so we actually have to change the point in time where the spark occurs to keep the engine from knocking itself to pieces.
So are you saying the hydrogen or water or HHO or whatever injection that you guys are experimenting with, it creates a knocking condition? Does it increase the velocity of the flame front? Is that what you're saying, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, you know, the typical gasoline engine, the spark does not fire top dead center. The typical gasoline engine is between 8 and 10 degrees off top dead center. You're aware of that, right?
Absolutely. You have to fire the spark early so that the flame front starts spreading across the cylinder of compressed gases so that you start getting the power stroke just at the time that the piston is beginning to descend. So you have to start the process early because of flame velocity within the cylinder. When I add these other water-like substances, does that flame velocity increase or decrease? In other words, do I do more advance or less advance of the spark? Over to you, Eric.
All right, first of all, you've got to stop thinking water, okay? Don't think water. Think hydrogen gas, all right? Think Hindenburg. Take hydrogen and oxygen, like the old high school experiment where you took a orange juice carton, you put a piece of magnesium ribbon in it, filled it up with water, you put in two parts hydrogen, one part oxygen, put it on a ring stand, and took like three yardsticks and taped them together while you let the magnesium ribbon. Okay, so we're talking about a very rapid burning, a very rapid combustion, where gasoline is kind of slow. And the whole point of the idea of burning the gas is that you get this increase in volume of burnt gases that take up more room, which push the piston down, which give you the power stroke. So when you introduce something that accelerates the burning process, even though the gasoline is burning slowly, you're also adding oxygen to it, which makes it burn a little faster, a little hotter. You're also burning the hydrogen along with it. So, you know, you think of your gasoline as maybe, let's take something like sugar, like, you know, C6H12. We've now made it H24, so we have more hydrogen atoms that are working for us, and the flame propagates faster, so we've got to fire the spark a little bit earlier.
You said the spark, you said the flame travels faster, and you said you fired the spark.
I'm sorry, I mean later.
Okay. Petroleum products, when oxidized, give out something in the vicinity of 144,000 BTUs per gallon. When I take this more exotic mixture that you're talking about, is there any significant difference in the BTUs per gallon of that mixture? Eric, go ahead.
Okay, you're talking X number of BTUs per gallon under normal air pressure conditions, okay? Normal, 23% oxygen. But don't forget, there's a lot of nitrogen in the air and a lot of other gases. What you've done now is you've actually increased the amount of oxygen available for that combustion. You've also added another element into it, so that's why we call it an assist. And actually, you increased the BTU output of the whole mess.
Okay, when I burn gasoline in my internal combustion engine, my four-stroke internal combustion engine, the Carnot cycle has a certain amount of efficiency. I get a certain number of BTUs of both thermal energy and mechanical energy out of that engine.
And you lose an awful lot of it through heat.
Yes, I said thermal energy. That's going to go to the radiator. So I can take the thermal energy going to the radiator, the mechanical energy coming out of the crankshaft. I can combine the two with the right conversion factor, and I think I'm going to come up with overall, assuming that I've done complete oxidation, that I'm not making a whole lot of carbon monoxide. I'm really making carbon dioxide and water. As long as I'm getting complete combustion, I think whether I do it under high pressure, low pressure, or whatever, I think the total energy output of mixing oxygen and this petrochemical fuel, I get something very close to 144,000 BTUs of total energy output. Does this more exotic fuel that you're describing increase that number of BTUs per gallon? Over to you, Eric.
Yes, it does. It increases the number of BTUs generated by that reaction. And, of course, if you've ever had, you know, a Corvette or anything with a turbo in it, you're essentially trying to do the same thing. You want to get more BTUs per gallon out of that particular fuel that you're using. And you do that by compressing the air before you put it into the cylinder. When you compress the air, you actually increase the number of oxygen molecules available for that given volume of gas. So that speeds up the reaction too. By the way, cars, internal combustion engines are anywhere between 20 and 40% efficient. You know, a lot of that stuff wasted heat energy, a lot of thermal energy, but what you can do is, you know, if you're doing this hydrogen thing, you can put a turbo on there and a generator and make some electricity with that wasted energy.
KC2, QAQ.
Glenn recognized, but I got a quick question for you, Eric. When I'm using a supercharger on my automobile that's properly equipped for it, you'd be amazed. A guy I work with has put a supercharger on his automobile, and he's now on his fifth engine. He's slowly catching on that an engine that's not beefed up for it is going to be at high risk when you do this, but that's another whole subject. That supercharger on the engine can give me easily 2 atmospheres of pressure at the carburetor. Therefore, I'm putting a higher density of stuff into that cylinder, and I get more horsepower output. But I have to put in more fuel. I don't get that extra horsepower for free. I'm putting in a higher pressure of air, more oxygen, and I'm also putting in more fuel. I'm not getting something for nothing here. I don't think the supercharger all by itself is substantially changing the efficiency of that internal combustion engine. If anything, it's slightly decreasing it, but I am getting more horsepower output. Am I slightly on target on this one? Eric, go ahead.
Before Eric, if you can also mention the water vapor.
Slightly on target. You're almost perfect, but not absolutely perfect, because yes, it takes more fuel to generate more output, but you're burning more efficiently if you actually calculate the amount of exhaust products that are happening. You're getting more complete combustion with the supercharger. Yes, it's going to take more fuel because you're now cranking this thing faster, which means you haven't given volume of fuel that's going into the cylinder each time. You can't, what you're trying to say is to reduce the amount of fuel, increase the amount of oxygen. That works to a degree, but, you know, what you're doing is improving the efficiency of the burning process. So, you know, oxygen supports combustion.
Okay, let's run this by one more time. If I rate the true mechanical efficiency of horsepower per gallon, so to speak, of my internal combustion engine, and now I properly set it up with a supercharger where the thing is running on 2 atmospheres, will that overall Carnot cycle have a higher mechanical efficiency because it is a supercharged engine? Over to you, Eric.
Is supercharging different than supercharging?
All right, let me give you this much, Dick, okay? When you supercharge an engine, you're increasing the amount of horsepower that it's capable of producing, right? If you turn the supercharger off, you're still using the same volume of gas to put into that cylinder. You don't get the same amount of horsepower, so you can kind of figure that out there. You know, there's still mechanical inefficiencies in the whole thing. Don't forget, with the HHO, we're adding more hydrogen into the process, so that's where you're getting an increase in BTUs in that respect. So, anybody else wants to talk about supercharges, go right ahead.
And to XGN. Well, actually, the water vapor, and Dick actually agreed with me, in the very cloudy days, the motor runs better. This compressed water vapor has actually changed into HHO during process of combustion. So, Eric, pick up.
KC2QIQ.
Yeah, let's pick up Glenn. Go ahead, Glenn.
There's another station in there, Dick.
Dick, you want to recognize the other station first, and then I'll pick it up?
Okay, who's the other station? This is K2RIW.
Kilo Bravo 2, Mike Alpha Romeo. Turbocharging is different than supercharging in that turbocharging, like you said, puts in more air. Supercharging gives you more gas than air. Back to you.
Can I pick it up now, Dick?
You got it, Eric.
Eric or me?
Means you, Glenn.
Yeah, Glenn, sorry about that. You got it, Glenn.
Okay, first let's talk about water for a minute. Dielectric strength of water is terrible. It's not even close to anything near what air or vacuum is going to give you. It's like 80 volts per mil. It's miserable. So, as a matter of fact, it's way, way, way down there. It might have a very, very high dielectric strength, but the dielectric strength is terrible, but its resistivity is very, very high. Supercharging, on another note, is basically a mechanically driven unit, and a turbocharger is driven by the exhaust. So in other words, depending on how you want to increase the pressure, the pump on the top of the engine, turbocharging is basically exhaust is moving an impeller, and the supercharger is directly driving with a belt. Let it drop for a second.
By the way, I've been talking about turbos, not supers.
Well, either one, it doesn't make too much of a difference. Basically, what's happening is, if you look at a combustion chamber, you have compression ratio, RPM, a few variables inside that equation for what to actually develop horsepower. But there's a thing called volumetric efficiency. That's actually, if at one atmosphere, basically how efficient is the combustion system inside the chamber from top dead center to bottom dead center, and that's what generally determines